The Meaning of Geranium from The Secret Language of Plants by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 15. If You Know the Rules. Narcissa did not have her own rooms in the manor. She could, because it was not unusual for the lord and lady of the house to sleep in separate beds after an heir had been produced. It was classy, and it gave the husband more freedom to bring his lover. But the house was not as it used to be. It had become Voldemort's court, and there were now many people living in there, a constant traffic of visitors coming and going. The main bedroom had been surrendered to Voldemort, Lucius's idea. They had taken the second best. Bella and her husband were occupying another one, and of course Rabastin needed his own. The Averys were always coming and going, as were the Molzeber brothers and their mother, that was it. The manor was big, but it did not have that many bedrooms. It was about having big rooms and an impressive catalogue of books and artifacts. There was a bedroom that remained locked and unused, and Narcissa never dared going there no matter how much she wished to. She could not afford being caught there, but at least she could make sure it was not occupied by anyone else. At the moment, she was in the room she shared with Lucius, the wife's room. She wished she could have it all to herself, but it wasn't too bad. Lucius was desperate to regain the lost favor and throwing himself into the Dark Lord's service. He was out most of the time and spent many nights in the hotel in London. Even when he came to the manor, he hardly touched her, which was a blessing because she could not stand his touch anymore. He had slept with her the night after the White Hair battle, when he had successfully protected the foreign delegation and injured Kingsley Shacklebolt, presumed dead now. Narcissa had endured, and then he had been gone for the next 2 weeks. He was gone now, too. Everybody was gone, and Narcissa was the single inhabitant of the house. She hadn't been alone in the manor in years. Probably since the Triwizard Tournament, when Draco was still in school and Lucius still took those trips to the city, and neither Bella nor Voldemort had come to take the house from them. She was completely alone. Even the house elves were gone. One outside, clearing the dry leaves from the garden, the other attending to the peacocks. Narcissa could spare a few minutes to go to the bedroom that remained locked. If she opened and closed the door quickly, she would hardly disturb the air in the room. It was full of dust. She didn't touch anything so she wouldn't leave obvious marks. There was a thin gray layer over the desk and the things there. A few books, a few pieces of parchment with drawings in the corners. The bed was just as it was, and she lifted the blankets carefully coming to her knees, so she could inhale the faint aroma that she believed was still in the sheets. He smelled so good. She didn't know how to call it, but he had always smelled like something clean and crisp. Like something that belonged to the sun and the sky. Her son smelled like the wind after the rain. And they were all out there chasing him. Narcissa was alone because they were all out there hunting her little boy. She felt the vomit come up, and she left the room quickly. She didn't want to spoil the aroma, the invisible traces that still remained of Draco. She threw up in the corridor and stayed there for long minutes on her hands and knees, retching and throwing up little more than spit and bile. She murmured Evanesco and the stain was gone. But the acrid smell remained in her mouth and her hair. And that horrible burning sensation from her stomach went up her chest and to her mouth and eyes. What could she do? She could do nothing, not even hope. She could do nothing but wait. Wait and see what news they brought. "I don't want to sound impatient," whispered Hermione, "but isn't this taking too long? You would think they would take more of an interest." She had acquired a sweater. It was white with two blue and red stripes on the neck and the sleeves. White was hardly the best color to wear when you were on the run, and she had said so, but Draco was very insisting that it was her color, and in any case, it was wool and very warm. She played with the cuff. The sleeves were a bit too long. "I really don't know who could be keeping them," Draco whispered back. They had cast Muffliato around them, but they were not taking any chances. The plan was already risky enough as it was, absurdly risky, but Hermione was dead certain that it would work, just as Harry had known they wouldn't be recognized in the Ministry and Draco had known where to look for an exit. Hermione wasn't very good with emotions, hers or anyone else's. She had always exhibited more awareness than Ron, it's true, but that was more due to Ron having a philosophical acceptance of life than to any particular sensitivity on Hermione's part. She was not very good with emotions because emotions clouded judgment, and Hermione put all her might into a razor-sharp mind. This is something that she understood very well. This is why that morning after breakfast she had unfolded a piece of parchment on the table. Sadly, there were only two notebooks in the house, and they were mostly full, and had announced with great assuredness that Voldemort must have been, and still was, very scared. That was the gist of it. After the duel and escape from Grimmauld Place, after seeing every person he ever killed come back to face him, the man who used to be Tom Riddle had to be scared. Scared of Harry Potter and his crazy powers, scared of his inability to defeat that strange boy, scared of himself failing and of death, finally catching up to him. Scared people don't think straight. People in desperate need of a win are rarely thinking at all. All of these things led Hermione to believe that he could be manipulated into revealing the nature and location of the elusive third Horcrux, the other two being the snake and whatever it was he had most certainly hidden in Hogwarts. "It'll probably be a historical relic." Harry had looked down at the list they had quickly rewritten from memory. Helga Hufflepuff had a cup, Rowena Ravenclaw a diadem and a hand mirror. Slytherin had the locket, which we already got, and a quill that was probably lost in some goblin war. "Then there is Godric's girdle." "That is not a thing," Hermione had said quickly. She knew because she actually paid attention 80% of the time in History of Magic class. Draco only listened around 40% to get an idea of what they were covering and studied the subject on his own. Apparently the notes he made were legendary and jealously sought after. "No?" Harry had blinked, perplexed. "No, Harry, it's just an expression," Draco had said, and because he had a ridiculous crush, he had sounded sweet and fond rather than irritated and personally offended. His rants over historical mistakes were also legendary. There had been one time in second year when Theodore Knott had purposefully mixed Nag at the Destroyer with Glad at the Firebreaker out of boredom. The tantrum didn't reach Snape, but the prefects did take Knott aside and gave him a long speech about deliberately reeling up Slytherins who shared bedrooms, bathrooms, study rooms, and dining tables with them, and were also in the Quidditch team, and had been talking about the cultural and economic differences between goblins and giants nonstop for the last 15 hours. From then on, Knott limited himself to Ravenclaws, who were very good targets, and kept their frenzies to their common room and, at most, the library. Draco smiled as he ruffled Harry's hair and kissed him on the cheek. "Like Merlin's pants," he said. "Godric Gryffindor had a sword." "And the hat, the sorting hat," Hermione had added. "He might have had a girdle too. Harry, do you even know what a girdle is?" Hermione had asked slowly in her prefect tone. A dangerous tone designed to create a false sense of security. George had accidentally confessed to the existence of the Skiving snack boxes because of it. He just couldn't help bragging in front of her. Harry had paused to think about it. "It's something you wear, isn't it?" "Yes, to tuck the belly and make a slimmer waist." "He might have been wearing one if he was concerned with physical appearance." "It would not be common knowledge," Draco had noted. He knew his father had worn one on occasion when he wanted to particularly dress to impress. So did Knott's father, no clue about the son. Regardless, it didn't matter so much what it was. They were all pretty certain they could recognize a Horcrux by now. It was the wear that eluded them. "You are absolutely certain that they sent a letter?" asked Draco, now looking down.
"Yes, sir," answered the house elf. Murphy was her name. "And the young mistress came half an hour ago and told Murphy to light the fire in the library so she could go to the Ministry herself." Well, then I don't know what to say. Draco sounded amusedly miffed, like a rich person peeved by the discovery that their highly exclusive club was now accepting unsuitable candidates like women or foreigners. You would think that they would be more diligent. They were talking about undesirable number one. The plan, as first presented by Hermione, was extremely simple. Make Voldemort believe that they were preparing to destroy the Horcrux. Not a Horcrux, but the Horcrux. The one whose whereabouts they wanted to learn about. Phase two, wait, and see what he said. Of course, this plan entailed some negative consequences, like Voldemort upgrading his security measures, but there was nothing comparable to not knowing where to go. So whatever new curse he cast, whatever monster he added to the dungeon, they would get around it. There was also the possibility of them tipping him off without actually learning anything, if only he kept quiet about his fears. But that's why they had to act now. Both Hermione and Harry still had scratches from the splintered wood of the door and bruises from where they were thrown back as said door blew up. The panic and the chaos was still very recent, and he had to be scared. They just had to dress it right. Funnily, Harry was the one who came up with the general idea of how to play it while Draco provided the details. Voldemort might suspect a chance encounter or another break of the taboo, but he would accept a betrayal. If Harry were to confide in someone and that someone were to tell Voldemort, nobody would question it. So they had to find themselves some nice people that would betray them and sell them to Voldemort, someone in which Harry could reasonably trust and expect their help. Gryffindor would be ideal. There was, of course, the part where Harry had to face and escape Voldemort again, and someone had to stay behind and listen, and they couldn't say too much right away or Voldemort would protect the Horcrux before coming for Harry. They had to make him come to where they were, and then, when he asked the traitor, hope that he would puzzle out what Harry was supposed to be doing, and subsequently let them know what they were supposed to be doing. All this, however, took hardly 30 minutes of planning. The real obstacle was finding adequate traitors and figuring out a good spot from which they could listen. Honestly, it was absurdly difficult. "I am learning a lot about people," Harry said. Mostly he was learning that people were wildly unpredictable and very complex. For example, there were perfectly horrible people. People who made Harry grit his teeth, like the Longbottoms, who would nevertheless lay down their lives to save Harry Potter. And then there were wholesome and nice people like the Davies, who liked sports and looked healthy and were polite, and yet they had a statue of a wizard stepping over a muggle in their front garden. Harry's dislike of the Longbottoms came as a surprise to both Hermione and Draco. It was particularly intense, and it made Harry so angry he could not speak. All he could say about the topic was that they were not good people. Neville was. Neville was great, and Harry loved him, which explained why he disliked the rest of his family so much. The Davies were much nicer, and Harry remembered Roger Davies' Ravenclaw keeper fondly. They would have been a perfect choice, and it would have been quite understandable if Harry were to ask for their help, if only they hadn't put up a sign saying, "Keep the line clean," in their living room window. Harry was notoriously absent-minded, but pretending he hadn't noticed that might be a bit of a stretch. They were debating the merits of trying a certain Gertha Ollivander, sister or cousin of the Wandmaker, Draco wasn't sure, based on the fact that Ollivander was a pure-blooded family, and the three of them agreed that Garrick Ollivander was weird and a bit sinister. They were going to check out the surroundings of the house when Draco stopped suddenly and stared down the street. He stood there for a whole minute with a look of deep thought about him. They said nothing. Harry took slow, even breaths and rolled his shoulders a little bit and focused on the glamour charm shielding them. The streets were quite empty, so they felt that even with the glamour they were bringing attention to themselves just by being there. Hermione had her wand ready and her back to them, carefully looking around for any potential threat. "Them," said Draco as he started walking down the street. He stopped again when the street became wider, taking a small step back so they wouldn't be so in the open. The building behind them was casting a small shadow, and it felt appropriate to stand in it. But it was also kind of cold, so it felt even more appropriate to take any sun rays they could get. They had made some cloaks with the ministry robes from yesterday, but they had come a bit short, just about waist length, and they were not too warm. "Which house are we looking at?" asked Harry. He had both his hands under his armpits to keep them warm.
That one, the brick one with white and red shutters.
It's nice.
That is the Bones house.
Susan's family? Weren't they all in the ministry? Asked Hermione in a whisper.
Her aunt was in the Wizengamot, answered Harry, happy to be able to answer this kind of question for once. Saw her in the fifth year.
He frowned a bit, trying to remember.
I think I may have fought her in my first year. Susan, I mean, not the aunt. And second year, too. She acted like she knew everything just because her family worked there. Ron called her a trollhead for me, and McGonagall barely took any points for it.
Hermione shrugged.
So are we trying them? She asked.
Ernie's family were also well-positioned in the ministry, and he always spoke as if he were the minister's confidant. There was a very obvious parallel. Besides, Susan was one of those girls with a perpetual air of sadness, and Hermione found it very irritating even if she understood that Susan couldn't help the way her eyes and brows were set.
No, said Draco simply.
He turned to look at them.
The Bones are Dumbledore loyalists, and Amelia Bones has been presumed dead for weeks. Really, weren't we reading the same newspaper?
Obviously not. Draco had an unfair advantage. He knew all the names and who was married to whom.
She apologized to me for the things she had said about my dad, whispered Harry.
And I think she apologized to Neville, too.
It doesn't matter.
Draco was back to looking intently at the house.
That is the Bones residence, but the man that just went inside was not Petronius Bones.
Maybe he was a visitor.
With his own key, I don't think so. That's a new family
living in the Bones house. They knew what it meant. This wasn't something that made it into the prophet, but after yesterday's visit to the ministry, they knew and they understood. It was the people who didn't believe in the nightmare that Voldemort offered, but who thrived under it. People who, as they saw the world burn, would stand to the side, hoping to cook some sausages for free, and whistling to drown out the screams of those burning.
So who was it?
Asked Harry from the hedgerow of the house's back garden.
I am not completely sure, whispered Draco, also from the hedgerow and standing tiptoe to get a better look. But he looked like a Diggory.
He what? Hermione, who was on lookout, turned around to stare as if Draco had said that he had seen Minerva McGonagall doing cartwheels in the garden.
Oh, hush, not those idealist nature lovers from the Hufflepuff branch. I meant one of the elder brothers.
Cedric is an only child. Nobody's talking about Cedric, Harry. He's a Hufflepuff and the son of a third child, being selected for the Triwizard Tournament in the most interesting thing that will ever happen to him. Why do you think most of Slytherin was supporting Crumb? He was already a professional player. His social capital was astounding.
You didn't know about those things, then?
We didn't know the name, but we were all well aware of the importance of social relations and alliances, and your friend Cedric was not well positioned. His uncles, on the other hand.
Ravenclaws, both of them. They had carved out good positions for themselves. One in the Department of International Relations, and the other in a lawyer's office in Diagon Alley. They did not claim to be pure-blooded because it hadn't occurred to them before, and it didn't offer an obvious advantage as it did now. They did not want to get excited, but it looked as if they had found their Pettigrew.
There was a small wooden door in the hedge, and from what they could see between the leaves and the planks of the door, the yard was empty. Draco said that the door would probably be rigged with an alarm if they tried Alohomora, but Harry thought that they could open it if they levitated the hatch from the other side, which was very clever. It worked, but it took them over 10 minutes and multiple attempts, and in the end only Hermione had enough patience to keep trying. The door swung open silently. They were holding their breath. Now it was just a question of finding a way to sneak inside the house and leave an exit open, and then Harry could circle back and knock on the front door to start the charade, and there was a pair of big blue eyes staring at them. The owner was so short that they hadn't seen him before. Here they were, the boy who lived, the boy who broke his wand, and the brightest witch of their generation, frozen in place by a pair of serene blue eyes.
Meppy?
Called a woman's voice in an impatient tone. Their eyes went from the short figure standing before them to the open door to the house in the background.
Yes, miss,
answered the figure, Murphy, a house elf.
Probably female, now that they looked better at her, though you could never know for sure the way they were dressed in rags.
My shoes and cloak are full of mud. Clean them.
The voice spoke quickly and animatedly, but it had some quality that Harry couldn't identify and that made his skin crawl.
I don't need the green dress after all. Put it back. Is there someone at the back door? I think I felt the crying violas humming.
Ask me for food,
whispered the elf, still staring straight at them. In fact, her eyes hadn't moved at all. Hermione was the first to speak.
Could I have some food, please?
She had her wand gripped tight, and her left hand was already coming to grab Harry by the neck of his jumper. The elf did something with her eyebrows to indicate this was not enough.
Can I have something to eat? Tried Harry.
It's just some mudblood's begging for scraps, miss,
the elf screamed back, her eyes still on them like an invisible force keeping them on the spot.
Well, send them out,
said the voice from inside. She went on to say it was not their problem if they were hungry and that people should be ashamed to go and sully a good house's reputation like theirs. Then she gave some more domestic orders to the house elf before getting out of hearing. Still, Harry couldn't shake the feeling that he knew that voice, even though he also believed he had never heard it before.
"Would you be so kind as to step out, please?"
said the elf. She had gray skin and ragged and tattered clothes of different colors that didn't look like much against the cold, despite how many layers she was wearing. And there was also something about her that reminded them of Luna Lovegood. Here she was, small and fragile and barefoot and looking very calm and self-possessed. They stepped back and let the door swing closed. Their hearts were beating madly and Harry's palms had begun to sweat. They still didn't know whether to count themselves lucky or not.
Is there any way Murphy could be of assistance?
She could maybe not appear behind them without so much as a poof, yes? That would be a good thing for their continued health.
It would be an honor and a pleasure, sirs, madam,
Murphy said, and for the first time there was something a little bit like enthusiasm in her otherwise perfectly calm and emotionless voice. They stared. Never one to be left speechless for long, Draco asked whether it was the Diggorys living there after all. It was. Diggory from International Relations, plus his wife and daughter, who, as luck would have it, was a Gryffindor, although she had left Hogwarts before Harry's arrival. Murphy also informed them that she didn't think this was a good place for them, which was exactly what they wanted to hear. Murphy was an elf with ideas.
I realize this may not be the moment, said Hermione. But have you heard of the SPEW? It's part of the platform for race, blood, and species equality now. There is help if you need it.
Look, the elf was barefoot and they were in winter. Hermione might have learned to frame her speech better thanks to Sabada, but she would not let pass the opportunity to help.
Well, Murphy is not allowed to read any of that rubbish, miss,
said the elf, gently shaking her head.
Mistress expressly forbid it.
Of course she had. Harry looked back to the house. They could only see the windows on the second floor from where they were standing. Harry could not imagine a bigger punishment than being forbidden to read. And he had actually been tortured by both Voldemort and Umbridge.
Murphy is not forbidden from listening to it, though,
she went on, still with that pleasant tone of the house elves. That was the thing about them. They could speak of the most horrible things, and they would make it sound as if they were talking about the quality of the linen.
Boggy from the Longbottoms told Murphy all about it, and Master Cedric said a lot too, back when he could still come to the house.
Master Cedric had been very busy. Master Cedric had received a letter from a certain Slytherin prefect telling him about rising awareness and positive portrayal in media, and how he had just the right chin for the job. It might be that Draco was wrong about Cedric's prospects in life because Master Cedric had been quite unashamedly using his good looks and his voice to whisper words here and there, and he hadn't let things like being disowned and exiled stop him. They said that house elves liked serving and that they obeyed mindlessly, but this was not Harry's experience. Of all the house elves he had met, only Winky, Barty Crouch's elf, had seemed truly subservient. Dobby helped Harry and tried to warn him of Lucius's plan. He punished himself for it, which was horrible. But the important thing here was that Dobby did something for himself, even if he was later compelled to hurt himself for it. Creature, too, never let an opportunity pass to express his true feelings, even while he kept a deferential appearance. He showed quite a lot of cheek, and Harry loved it, even if he was often the one at which the disrespect was directed. Poor creature. He hoped he had made it to Hogwarts okay. Now house elves barely got any education, and of course they would never attend Hogwarts as students. The school was for pure humans only. Flitwick and Hagrid and Remus had had a lot of trouble getting in. But if they were to attend, and if they were to be sorted, there was absolutely no doubt that Murphy here would be a Slytherin. The sorting hat would be yelling the answer as soon as she got to the Great Hall. Murphy did not like the idea of either of them hanging near the house, but it took her 10 seconds flat to figure out that if they were still there, it was because they wanted something despite the danger. Certainly she could not reveal her master's secrets or steal one of their possessions, but there was no rule against inviting people inside, especially someone as popular in the ministry as them and friends of Cedric. They had forbidden him to return, but funnily they had said nothing of the people associated with him. Which is to explain why Hermione and Draco were currently sitting in the Diggorys' kitchen eavesdropping on Harry's conversation with Mrs. Diggory. Had Sirius been there, he would have been so proud of Harry.
Oh, good afternoon, sir. Sorry for coming here uninvited,
he had said as Leon Diggory came to the lobby with his eyes bugging out to find that Murphy had been perfectly accurate as to who was waiting in the entrance.
My name is Harry Potter. You may know me as the boy who lived. Is this a bad time?
Of course it wasn't. Regardless of allegiance and ideology, if Harry Potter came to your house, you invited him in and gave him tea. He was simply not the kind of person who could be ignored or dismissed. Their manners might have failed a little bit, due to the shock, but Potter certainly didn't comment on it. How could he? He had been raised by a werewolf, after all. The fact that he had introduced himself politely was nothing short of a miracle. They went to the living room, and while the wife, Ida, served him a cup of tea herself, Harry explained that he needed to borrow a staff of broken willow if they had any, so he could perform a ritual that would destroy an object that, as he understood it, was very important for Lord Volt. Whoops. Excuse him there. Ha-ha, so sorry. But they knew who he meant. Anyway, did they have something like what he was describing? It was very important. He could wait. Even before he was done explaining, the Diggorys had already scrambled to send a note to the ministry. This was going to give them all they ever wanted. This would erase them not being Slytherins or part of the Sacred 28 and even all the nonsense of their nephew Cedric. The Dark Lord would reward them handsomely. Leon would be promoted, no doubt, and Edith would make a good marriage and they would get a new house, a manor this time. Only he wasn't coming. They had sent word that Harry Potter, undesirable number one, was at their house and Lord Voldemort wasn't coming. Neither him nor anyone else. They had sent an owl saying that Harry Potter was at their house and apparently no one was interested. That simply made no sense. Thankfully, Leon had exhibited some quick thinking and said that they did possess a couple of broken willow branches, just as the ones Harry had described. He would go to retrieve them presently if Potter could show some patience and wait here. This should do to keep him in place. There was no reason to worry just yet. It had only been 20 minutes, after all. Perhaps the message was taking a bit longer in reaching the Dark Lord. That way, perhaps Leon could be there to greet him when he came. It was always important to get people to know your face. Ida and Edith would make sure that Potter didn't go anywhere. Only that had been hours ago, and still nothing. Ida was beside herself with nerves. For the most part, Potter was happy to stay there and make conversation. He couldn't tell much about his mission, only that there was something of Voldemort's he needed to retrieve, but twice already he had awkwardly remarked that it was taking quite a long time for Leon to return. Fortunately, their daughter Edith rose to the occasion and said that indeed it was taking quite long, but you know how it is with old houses like theirs. It is almost impossible to find anything. She would go now and help Papa look. She had given her mother a meaningful look as she left the room. Ida had taken comfort from it, but she was also growing more and more anxious. She did not know what she would do if Potter decided to leave. Stop him, of course. Stupefy should do it, since everybody knew the boy was little more than a squib. But still, Ida was terrified that something would happen and he would get away. He was known for that, too. Harry Potter refused to die, kept disappearing.
"This room is lovely," he said. "I like the curtains."
It would be fair and accurate to say that everyone in the house was having a terrible time. Even Murphy, and she had been quite happy to have the opportunity to help Hermione Granger, and Harry and Draco, of course, but there was an obvious preference. Leon Diggory was currently hiding in his own cellar, quietly building a holding cell where they could put Potter if he tried to leave the house. He was sure that they could stop him if that were the case, because the boy hardly deserved to be called a wizard. To think that he had competed against his nephew, really, what an insult. That was all Dumbledore, you know, pushing this sad excuse of a half-blood wizard into the tournament. But the boy was almost feral. Everybody knew that, so Leon would feel better if they put him behind bars, so the women of the house would not have to be afraid of him. Conjuring the iron bars and drilling them in the stone was proving harder than expected. Leon's feet and hands and nose were cold from his long stay there, and he was not having a good time. So far, this sudden strike of good fortune had brought him a lot of trouble, a headache, and a principle of a cold. Though, of course, he was still far from thinking that. He just wished that someone would answer his call soon. Ida Diggory was not having a better time, even though she was sitting in her living room drinking tea. It was her second cup, and she was taking very small sips, so it wouldn't look like they had been sitting there so long. Potter was still with his first cup, which he had barely touched. All her energy was directed to Potter, to being pleasant and keeping him there and smiling and nodding along to his bumbling explanation. It was exhausting. She felt as if she had run for miles when she hadn't moved from her chair in hours. She wished she had put a sleeping draught in the tea, but it was too late now. She didn't dare excuse herself from the room even for a second, lest she were to return and find Potter gone. Even Harry was a bit uncomfortable. He knew perfectly well what was happening in the house, he knew what he was waiting for, and this long wait was throwing him off balance. Mostly it was the obvious distress of Mrs. Diggory that was enhancing his own anxiety. She probably hadn't noticed, but she had ruined the skirts of her dress with how tight she was grabbing the fabric. Plus, even though she was trying to be a nice host and she actually had pretty good manners, there was something about her unerringly similar to Petunia Dursley. And it made sitting there with her all the more intolerable. It was the way she spoke. Harry couldn't take it. Meanwhile, Draco and Hermione were equally worried about the long wait, but they were also in the kitchen drinking tea and eating Murphy's fabulous raspberry scones, so they really couldn't complain. It had been 3 hours now since Harry had knocked on the door and 30 minutes since the daughter flew to the ministry. The sun had set, and there was something oddly upsetting about the nightfall coming while they were hiding in an enemy's house. For her part, Edith Diggory was not having a better time, even though she was not out the house. In fact, she was having the worst time of all. She had reached the ministry, and not only had she not found anyone who could take her message, she was receiving quite a lot of questions about her arrival. Even once she managed to get rid of the pesky inspectors in the atrium, she found that the building barely held any aurors or special operators. All numbers had been called to attend to others' matters, it seemed. They spoke of some truly amazing event at the Leaky Cauldron. Of course, they had no way to know that currently all the Death Eater body, minus one, was investigating the sudden apparitions of Draco Malfoy and his tour of the country. Everyone else, special operators and simple ministry officials with no power of arrest, were busy getting the ministry back to order. There was a new head of security who still barely knew how to get to his office or who his employees were. They had lost years of work in the registration and identification fire, which meant they now didn't know who they were supposed to arrest next. And there was a silent but well-grounded panic seizing everyone after the realization that there was a morality and pure-blood spirit department no one knew about, which obviously meant that all of their workers were undercover and could be standing right next to you. As Severus had said, it was pandemonium. Definitely not the time for people to be checking the mail. Other than the Death Eaters stationed in strategic places like Snape and the Carrows, everyone else was making him or herself useful. Even Rodolphus Lestrange had been shaken awake from his usual half-dead stupor and sent to help with the Draco hunt. Even people that were considered inferior, like the werewolves, were brought to help.
Hell, they said that if they managed to capture Draco, they would be rewarded with the Mors Mordra brand on their arm. Them, half-breeds, carrying the most sacred brand. The only exception, the only person not fallen to the current madness, was Bellatrix Lestrange. After all, she had experience with insanity. She knew how to live and function with it. She also knew a diversion when she saw one. You see, Bella, as much as it pained people to admit, was intelligent. Bella could not help noticing that Draco Malfoy suddenly seemed to have a wand when he had broken his, and not only was he apparating despite not having received any lessons, but he was not raising any alarms for unlicensed apparition. Bella could see quite clearly that it was not Draco. It had been a very convincing portrayal of Draco Malfoy, effortlessly elegant and driven by a special kind of internal energy, but it was not him. Given that the rotten traitor boy and the mudblood girl and the abomination had been hiding in the ancestral seat of the Black family, it was no effort to imagine who was behind the impersonation. The house should have been Bella's. When Sirius showed his disloyalty and Regulus got himself killed, it should have gone to her. But she was a woman with no male heir, and so her claim had nothing to do against either Sirius's or Draco's. Some days Bella wished she could stick a knife in her sister's womb and make her barren as she was, make her pay with her blood for all the dishonor she had brought upon them, make her pay for the insults to Bella that was to be able to conceive and have a son, a boy, and ruin him. If Bella had a son of her own, or even a girl, she would have made him the best and most devoted servant of the Dark Lord. She would have offered him her son in sacrifice if he required it. Maybe she would have conceived by him. And then she wouldn't be giving him her son, but his son. But of course, no. Bella didn't get to be a mother, and she didn't get to have the house. All the things that were rightfully hers, they went to others, and they were undeserving, and they ruined them. She was not participating in the Draco hunt. There was no point. She knew Sirius. He would laugh like a fool as he strung them along, but he would not stay long enough to actually face any of them in combat. Such a Gryffindor he was, but he would not duel against them. She would kill him. When the time came, Bella would kill Sirius Black. She would kill that filthy little girl, Hermione Granger. She would kill Draco if Lucius didn't do it. She would kill Snape the moment he showed his true face. But now was not the time. She had tried to warn the others, and of course they had ignored her. Perhaps it was right for them to do so. They had their orders, from McNair and the Minister, and from the Dark Lord himself. They should not question them. It was up to Bella, then, to figure out what it was that her dear cousin didn't want her to see. Let him run and dance and laugh as everyone else played into his game and followed his trail. His diversion would also be Bella's. While he was busy running from them, she would find that half-breed he called his friend, and she would find whatever burrow they were hiding in, and she would have a party of her own.
Madam! Madam!
There was a girl screaming and waving while two idiots tried to push her away from the Auror office. Bella had been left alone with the clerks. Everyone who could present combat was gone.
Madam, please!
Bellatrix stared coldly and uncaring as they grabbed the girl's arms and dragged her outside. It was not uncommon for someone to send the eldest or youngest relative begging for something. If McNair had been here, the girl would have gotten an audience.
Don't you touch me! How dare you touch me! Madam, listen to me!
The girl was certainly more spirited than most. She elbowed idiot number one. Bella didn't know his name, it was the one with the teeth, and of course he released her to touch his nose. The girl twisted away from idiot number two and crossed the room quickly to where Bella was sitting, legs up on the desk. Today she was at what used to be Mad-Eye Moody's desk. Sadly, she did not know which ones used to be the Longbottoms.
Oh, madam,
she said, falling to her knees, it was quite good. She had the right intonation, and her dress folded beautifully as she kneeled. Most people tripped with the hem.
Get up, girl, and leave. That was well done, a good attempt. So I won't ask you your name. Know that that is a present.
Bella's attention was already back to the map on the opposite wall where a red dot came up whenever there was a breach of the taboo. A blue light should come with an unlicensed apparition, and so far she hadn't seen a single one of them.
"No, madam, you must listen to me."
While the girl was brave, she would give her that, stupid too. Most people understood that Bellatrix Lestrange not knowing your name as a very good thing if you had just annoyed her. Bellatrix glowered down at her, pinning her in place, and to her surprise, the girl looked back. You had to be very, very, very brave to look Bellatrix Lestrange in the eye. This was not something that stupid people dared to do. Edith Diggory was a Gryffindor. She would brave any obstacle to deliver her message. Bella had seen through the diversion, and she had learned some self-control, but she still had to work on that aspect. The fireplace in the living room was not lit, otherwise she would have gone directly to that room. As it was, she came running out of the fireplace in the Diggory's library and left the room without sparing a second for thought. She did not know the lay of the house, but she did not let that stop her.
"What's this, Mrs. Diggory?"
said Harry calmly over the resounding steps coming down the stairs. Why no one suspected Severus's involvement in his education remained a mystery.
"Have you perchance another visitor? I shall make my excuses then."
That said, because Harry still didn't know how to apparate, nor should he try without adult supervision, he simply opened the door and jumped out of there. It was a ridiculous thing to do. Mrs. Diggory should be excused for not rising sooner to stop him, and no one would expect anyone to exit through a window. Bellatrix Lestrange got to see as Harry got up from the crouch he had fallen into after the jump. She cast a curse quickly and instinctively, which Harry ducked without problem since he had only had to step away from the window. By the time Bellatrix had reached said window and peered out of it, there was no sign of Harry. No sign at all. He could not apparate. She knew he could not. So they wasted precious time looking around the garden and down the street while Harry settled quietly in the kitchen. House elf apparition. No one ever remembered it. Harry was a fan. It was less upsetting than sidelong apparition with an adult wizard, too. The kitchen was a fair distance away from the living room, yet they could hear perfectly well everything that was going on. Mostly it was Bellatrix expressing her dissatisfaction with the universe. Leon Diggory currently wished he had stayed in the cellar. Bellatrix had not been happy to see him and had blamed him for Potter's escape, even though he hadn't been in the room. Apparently he should have been, just as he should have made sure that the message was delivered earlier, rather than having to send his daughter. There were many accusations of lacking proper wizarding temperament and some threats of castration, since he seemed happy to act like an ox.
"Perhaps it's not too late,"
said Edith, who could see that her father was just one bad look away from being permanently maimed.
"He spoke of needing to go somewhere, didn't he, Mother? You sat with him for longer."
"Yes,"
Ida rushed to say. She would like for her husband to remain intact, even if she didn't appreciate how quick he had been to blame her.
"Yes, he came here asking for a branch of broken willow. He wanted to steal something from the Dark Lord, something important, he said."
This was it. They were finally on the topic. Only they wanted to overhear Voldemort's reaction, not Bella's, because they knew Voldemort hadn't exactly advertised the nature of the Horcruxes. Lucius certainly hadn't known, or he wouldn't have risked it like that. He believed it was a powerful, enchanted dark object that perhaps held some sentimental value. Of course, he could be excused for not thinking that it had a piece of Voldemort's soul, and that was not a thought that came often in life.
"Steal something!"
Bella's voice carried through the house like an electric shock. Her voice was like a toothache.
A valued possession of the Dark Lord,
came Ida's quivering voice, sounding quite a lot like Petunia. Harry had the sensation that maybe Bella knew what they were talking about, only he realized he could not really listen to it because Hermione was leaning against a wall, her hands coming to her knees just like when someone is lightheaded. Hermione was a pretty healthy girl. Perhaps not like Ginny, who seemed to be made of iron and stone and was very athletic, but he had never seen Hermione get sick. She did not get colds, and she never complained of any pain. Her chest and shoulders heaved. and Hermione opened her mouth to throw up. Draco turned to look at them, and Harry waved at him with his left hand. It was just a mad flail of his fingers trying to tell him that he should pay attention and learn all he could about the Horcrux, and maybe memorize whatever Bellatrix said word for word. Of course, Harry was listening too, but he was not paying attention anymore. Instead, he was grabbing Hermione's arms and pressing gently until she made eye contact with him. She was pale and looked like she had trouble breathing. Worst of all was the way she was looking at Harry, as if she had no idea of who he was and where they were. It was all Bella. They had been prepared for Voldemort himself, but Bella's presence was no good. It was a terrible thing to say, because Voldemort was a monster and a very powerful wizard, and his eyes were red, red. But Harry preferred him to Bella. There was something about that woman, some hidden quality, that felt like a razor dragging down your back. Voldemort was horrible, but in the same way that facing an angry tiger or a crocodile was horrible, he did not have that component that made you feel like you were facing that tiger in the dark and naked. Bella had tortured Hermione, and now they were listening to her making some horrible threats. Hermione was quiet, but she had tears in her eyes, and she had begun to sweat.
"You are not alone," whispered Harry, his hand still grabbing her forearms.
He didn't want to speak too much. It could alert them to their presence, and it could distract Draco from his eavesdropping.
"Can Merpy help in any way?"
"No. Yes, stay with Draco and pay attention."
"Say all you know! Clear and loud, or I swear I will cut out your tongue!"
"Shh." Harry helped Hermione to the floor so she wouldn't have very far to go if she fainted. She looked as if she had already fainted in a way. Her body was upright and her eyes open, but she did not look conscious in the least. She looked as if she were very far away and in pain. They all dealt with their traumas in their own way. For Harry, it was difficult sleep that only got better if he had someone by his side, and it was mostly about his fear of other people being hurt. He never had nightmares about Voldemort or Umbridge torturing him, but he had plenty in which he went dark. Although his skin actually became iridescent white in the dream, and he tortured the people he loved. Draco didn't have nightmares or crises, but sometimes the smallest thing could bring him to tears. Usually good things, things that perhaps he was experiencing for the first time without being afraid. He had looked really choked up when Sirius offered to teach him how to shave. Not that there had been much to shave at the time. Hermione had been mostly nightmare-free, and even if she had had some episodes when she remembered and the memories seemed to take over her, it had never been something as debilitating and paralyzing as this. Whenever they went outside on the Horcrux hunt, and even when Voldemort himself came to their door, she had been calm and efficient and wonderful, just like she always was.
"I will beat you with your own bones!"
Now she was on the floor and she couldn't breathe, and Harry could feel her pulse racing and jumping like a mad animal running towards a cliff, and he had no idea of what to do. He had no idea of what to do, but he understood. He knew it was that horrible woman screaming, and he knew that it was hurting Hermione. "I'm here with you," he said. "Hermione, I'm here with you. You are not alone this time."
"Well, take your eyes out and make you swallow them!"
"You're doing very well. You're very brave, Hermione. You're the bravest person I know, and I once pet a dragon." Somehow that brought something like a smile to Hermione's face, and from there it was easy to slowly help her get her breathing back. "Come on, Hermione. You were once under the lake for over an hour, and when you got back, I did not hear you gasp for breath. I mean, I'm sure there was some gasping in which Crumb was involved, but that was a different kind altogether, unless you have finally fallen into my charms. I know I'm irresistible. Sirius wouldn't stop berating me about my hair. Granted, it was about the split ends, but I know in reality he was just jealous." Eventually, Hermione punched him weakly on the arm so he would stop teasing her, and even though she didn't speak, Harry knew she was better. Bella wasn't screaming so much, satisfied with whatever they had told her, and no one was begging for mercy, which was quite reassuring. Harry brought Hermione a glass of water to rinse her mouth, and he cleaned up the vomit.
Is Miss feeling better?
Yes. Thank you, Murphy. Much better.
Will Miss take a chamomile tea? It will settle her stomach.
Bella ended up cursing Leon Diggory after all, although she did not castrate him, so he should consider himself lucky. It had not been the best moment to ask for a reward. He had kind of brought it upon himself. Bellatrix had said to Edith that they would keep in touch before leaving, so at least someone in the family had gotten some sort of influence. They called for Murphy then, to help open the bed for the master and bring him some tea, and since they knew they would be distracted, they used the opportunity to leave the house from the back door. They had already thanked the house elf profusely, and they had all shaken her hand, which made her quite happy. And Draco said he knew where to go. It turned out that Bella Cumming had actually been quite fortunate. She hadn't actually admitted to anything, but it had become evident through her increasing preoccupation that she knew about Voldemort having certain valued possessions, and that she feared in the extreme the possibility of losing one of them, which meant that she was the other Death Eater tasked with safekeeping a Horcrux. It was a relief, no, really. They had feared it were Barty Crouch, Jr., and that was someone who was in no position to tell them about it. Now they knew it was her, and even more, they knew it was a cup, probably Helga's famous goblet. Because she had been so distressed as to ask Ida if Harry had mentioned any cups. Ida had said yes, which was a lie, but since Bellatrix had been threatening to skin her to help her remember, it was to be expected. Draco said that there had been a Lestrange house which had been burned by an angry mob and later torn down after the war. It hadn't been anything as spectacular as his father's manor in any case. Few families had an estate like the Malfoys. In a way, Draco had come to understand the unconscious pattern Voldemort was following with the placement of his Horcruxes. It was all about difficulty of access. There was a cave with a lake, which was quite literally and evidently difficult. Then there was a snake at his feet, which was also difficult to get to. And then there was symbolic difficulty and social restriction. If they were right, there would be a Horcrux in Hogwarts. Hogwarts, one of the most emblematic wizarding buildings in Britain, and one that was not open to everyone. Just like Malfoy Manor was the manor, the house every other pure-blooded family aspired to possess. The cup would not be at the stupid Lestrange house any more than it could have been at the Black's house. It was obvious to Draco now. What else was wizarding and restricted? What else was safe, but, most important of all, completely inaccessible to a poor orphan? No, not just Gringotts. If you had 10 galleons, you could open an account in Gringotts. It was the safety vaults in the lower levels. The ones that were as old as the building itself and protected with everything the goblins could throw. The ones the goblins kept for themselves, for the biggest treasures of the bank. The ones with a number lower than 100. Draco knew that his grandmother's gift to Bella on her wedding day had been the title to Vault 76, something that neither Lucius nor Narcissa Malfoy had, something that neither Knott nor Parkinson nor Bellestrode nor Crabbe nor Goyle had. They said that Zabini's mother had one from one of her husbands, but who knew? They said many things about her. Bellatrix had Vault 76, and she had been worried about a cup. That was for sure. The house had been empty during the hours of light, but now Narcissa, like the sun and the light, had set back as others came with the darkness and the stars. A few Death Eaters, not her husband or Bella's, and Voldemort himself. A few Death Eaters who had abandoned the hunt for her son, because in the meantime they had found someone else. It was as if winter were throwing back the lost people, the people supposed to be dead. First Hallows' Eve gave them Montgomery and Alicia. Now, 10 days before the solstice, they had found Harry Potter with Draco and the girl. Today they had been running after her son, and they had gotten back another presumed dead. If Voldemort weren't standing there, Narcissa would admit that the plan had been good. Naive, but good. Mulciber had returned, weakened and tired. This was surprising, but not too much as to be suspicious. He was thin and pale, as if he had been locked in a dungeon for weeks, which was exactly what he said had happened to him. He had only just managed to escape from his imprisonment while the Order was distracted. He told his story, and it was good, and afterwards the Dark Lord looked him in the eye and simply said, "Crucio." It had been a good plan. The story was perfect, and they had taken care of the details. There was dirt under Mulciber's nails, and there was a smell of moist and dirt clinging to his robes. He didn't have his wand, but it was to be expected. He shouldn't have had it if he had been locked up. But people always seemed to forget or underestimate how much of a legilimens Voldemort was. Not her, certainly, and not her husband or Snape, but others did. Dumbledore's lackeys did. Narcissa hadn't spoken to her other sister in years. She did not know the girl that was currently on the floor screaming. Truly, she didn't think of it as her floor anymore. It was not her floor or her ballroom or her house. That place was not hers, just like that girl was not her niece. She didn't know her. She had been carrying a wand. Voldemort ordered Narcissa to retrieve it, which was oddly considerate. It would have been more invasive if it were his hands feeling around the leg and the strap. He had snapped it himself, though. And everybody had flinched, as they always did when they saw a wand snapped. It was like severing a hand. It was something that went to their cores. Narcissa felt nothing. Voldemort said that he would let Bella deal with the dirty girl. A gift to his most devoted and talented servant. But Bellatrix wasn't home yet from whatever secret errand she was running, and that had kept her away from the current mission. Narcissa didn't dare, thinking that it was out of deference to her, that Bellatrix was choosing not to escape and kill Draco so as not to hurt her. After all, Lucius had jumped at the opportunity. Narcissa thought that if she asked for it, Voldemort would give her the woman instead. She could do it easily. Say she could not stand the idea of that dirty woman in the house. That she would rather have the family tree cleaned and trimmed quickly. She did not know that girl, and she barely knew her sister. There had always been too much of an age difference, and Andromeda had left before Narcissa became a woman. But she knew the agony of having your child hurt. And she knew all too well that Bellatrix would not give her a quick and easy death. Narcissa only had to say a word, and she could spare a lot of pain to the girl, if not to Andromeda. But she didn't speak. She couldn't. She was too afraid to leave the safety of silence. Silence was good.
"What are you thinking about, Harry?" asked Hermione.
She was feeling much better already. Dinner and the stroll back home had done wonders. Besides, they were all used to not dwelling too much on the bad moments. They would never get anything done otherwise. Harry had made her a cranberry and orange scone, and that was it. They were going to bed soon. They were safe for the night, as no one was going to look for them in Chillington now. The plan was to get a few hours of sleep and leave on Broomstick before sunrise, even if Hermione hated it. She hated the broomstick, the sunrise, and the certainty that they would not get a good breakfast, no matter how many times Harry sang the magpie song. By then they had upgraded the security. Hell, Bellatrix might be standing on the vault chamber at this very moment if she had any idea of what they planned. But they would not have moved the cup from Gringotts. It was the safest place in Britain. No one could break in.
"Your future children," Harry said.
Hermione made a sound of horror, a bit like a startled elephant, and made every object in a 2-meter radius jump and fall to the ground. This was not insignificant, since they had been amassing quite a considerable collection of random objects. Stuff for Harry to transform or for Draco to use as a base for a wand. Sadly, there was still no notebook, which was the one single item Hermione had requested. At this point, she should know better than to ask Harry for his thoughts in the late evening and early night.
"Don't mind him,"
Draco said, folding another little package of ingredients.
The house had turned out to be quite useful in that aspect. He was an accident.
"I was born 2 whole years after my parents married," cried Harry,
because he was born recklessly soon, but he was not out of wedlock, not that it was very important. "Anyway, I was just thinking of future Hermione and her kids and how they will study a lot and be very proper and formal." Draco was nodding along because absolutely no one could imagine any other version of Hermione's children. The hair and skin color changed depending on the hypothetical father, but there was absolutely no doubt that with that mother, they would be good students that never got in any trouble. At some point, when they're teenagers, she will scold them for something very minor, arriving late at home or skipping the extra math lessons they'll be taking. You know she'll make them study math.
Absolutely.
Music lessons, too, Draco had no doubt, and 2 or 3 languages.
"I fail to see what the point is of any of this."
Hermione sounded slightly irritated, but also curious. This was one of those situations in which Ron would already be snickering.
"The point is that they'll be good formal students, and you'll reprimand them for some very small misdemeanor, and on that day, Hermione Gingrinder, on that day, dead or alive, or in ghost form, I don't care, I will come and tell them about the time that their mother was 18, and she was homeless and being hunted by the ministry. Homeless and living in sin with 2 extremely handsome young men," added Draco, because it had to be said.
"And you were swearing," Harry exclaimed, because it really had been a shock.
"And smoking." "I'm not smoking!"
"Don't worry about that. I will find you something to smoke." Draco patted her on the arm. "Maybe get a tattoo on your left butt cheek." He ducked just in time to avoid the rolled-up newspaper.
"What the fuck are they doing?"
Percy didn't usually swear, but he was alone. His mother would never know, and he felt like the situation merited it. A seer doesn't choose the prophecy. The prophecy chooses you, and yada yada, as if Percy cared about the theory. He had sort of learned to dismiss or call for specific visions in addition to the ones he was getting from the Unbreakable Vow, although it was all very unstable. From time to time, he got something that had nothing to do with him and the present situation, something that wasn't even bad and therefore not useful, and he didn't know what to do with it. He had seen himself eating a triple chocolate cake at a wedding. That was it. He didn't know who was getting married or where or when. He just knew that they would serve a triple chocolate cake and that it would be quite good. Mouth-watering, even. Percy was glad to know. There was someone sitting at his side in that vision. He didn't get to see who, but it was someone familiar, and their smell was absolutely enthralling. Now in between saving his father's life, again, and figuring out where exactly he was supposed to apparate to in a week's time, he saw freaking Harry Potter planning a break-in into Gringotts. Gringotts.
"Why are you showing me this?"
asked Percy of the universe. Why? Why indeed? He didn't need this. He didn't need the cake vision either, but he almost got to taste it in his lips and feel that maddening smell once more.
"I don't need this," he said aloud.
The universe, however, didn't care. Neither did the cruel gods that were sending him the visions. It was probably the same gods that had given him uncombable curly hair.
"Oh, for Merlin's sake," he went on, waving his eyes at the empty air. "They got caught. Of course they were caught. What did you expect, Harry? It's only the most secure building in Britain, and Hermione. I expected better of you. How could she go along with that plan? She's supposed to be the smart one here. Cersei's curls were all doomed. I see it now. It's up to me to save the world."
Percy took a couple of steps back and flopped down on the couch. His blue eyes were glazed over, lost in the distance and the time.
"Oh, thank Merlin, yes. Listen to her. And you've got to marry her, too. She's the only sensible person around here. No, for the fuck's sake. No. Step away from that. Step away. That's bound to blow up in your face, you idiot. Don't..." Oh, he did it anyway.
The vision vanished slowly, leaving Percy with a feeling of irritation he mostly felt whenever he saw his father sneaking away.
They better be the ones serving that cake.
End of chapter 15. For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 page as well as the Tumblr of author Andrina.
First Pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. If you would like to commission me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch using the contact information on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. And there you can find the stories that I've read, as well as links to my Patreon page, to which I hope you will consider subscribing to support me, and my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.